That's connected. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
It's not a trick, but if you had to guess what book in the Bible we were going to look at this morning, which one would you pick?
Genesis.
Give that man a prize. Genesis. Genesis chapter 50. The last chapter in the book of Genesis. So we must be getting near the end of this. Don't count your stars or count your pigeons or eggs or don't count things here. Never mind, I forgot where it was. Don't count your eggs before they hatch. Yes, we'll get there eventually. Yeah. We're just going to read a few verses from Genesis chapter 50. All right, verses 15 through to 21. I'm reading from the English Standard Version this morning rather than the NIV. It says this: when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgressions of your brothers and their sins, because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So basically, the brothers, with Jacob now dead, thought that perhaps Joseph had simply been waiting for this moment to come so that there was no offence or difficulties for his father. And now, with him being in such a powerful position, and now would be the time when he would execute his revenge upon them. Now, the fact of the matter is that he was more than capable of doing that. He was second in line to the throne. He was the one who was over all. He was the one that they had come to, and rightly so, bowed down before, because he was in a position of power over them. They could see this very dark cloud on the horizon. So they came up with a little scheme. Now, we know that this was a little scheme because, first of all, Jacob had spoken to Joseph at length, as we'd seen in the previous chapters. Never mentioned this at all. Didn't say, "Forgive your brothers for what they've done to you." He'd had one-to-one conversations with him. I mean, a few weeks ago, we were talking about how he called Joseph to him and blessed the sons of Joseph. He was Jacob's favourite son, and he was the one that Jacob spoke to more easily and more regularly than all the others. So if Jacob had at any time wanted to say, "Just leave it to one side, you know, don't take it out on them," he was more than capable of doing that. So here was this little scheme. I mean, why they even thought that there was any sort of chance of this running, I don't know. But they gave it a try. So they came up with this supposed message, you know, don't hold it against them, you know, let them off, they'll serve you and be subservient to you, but just don't take it out on them. But in it all, what we see is they really didn't understand Joseph. In many ways, they didn't know him. And it's pretty clear that they didn't actually believe him. What they had done in the past still haunted them. We saw when they came and Joseph revealed himself to them, they were absolutely struck dumb with terror. It tells in Genesis 45, when he says to his brothers, "I am Joseph, is my father still living?" It tells us that his brothers were unable to answer him because they were terrified. Their worst dream had suddenly become their living nightmare. This one that they had done this such a terrible deed to, take your own brother and then you sell him to get rid of him, suddenly they're confronted with not just a case of him coming back, but coming back with bells on. It says they were terrified, disturbed, alarmed, aghast, struck dumb, eyes wide open in horror. And even though at that time he had said to them, "Come close to me, don't be afraid, don't be distressed, don't be angry with yourselves," God has worked this out. This is part of God's purpose. And not only that, "I'm okay with it." Basically, they didn't believe him. They thought, well, maybe he's just waiting to get Jacob out of the way, then we're for it. But at that point, he could quite easily have done whatever he wanted to them. But he didn't, because he'd forgiven them. But what they had done was alive in them. You may recall that when they were first of all accused of various things, one of the first things they said was, "This has come on us because of what we did with Joseph." It wasn't a case of, "Oh, isn't it bad for us that this has worked out?" or "Isn't it terrible how this foreigner's treating us?" They said, "This has come about because of that." They hadn't let go. It was there. It was haunting them. They were living a constant lie before Jacob. Obviously, in some senses, it will get easy. I mean, over the first few weeks, months, you've got to sort of keep your mouth shut and just sort of go with it. And then obviously later on, it doesn't sort of have the same sort of heightened tension. But you've still got to live the lie that Joseph has been killed and Joseph is dead and nothing to do with us. But it shows how that was still alive in them. They were living with their guilt. And guilt has a purpose. But how do we react with guilt? We see various examples in the Word. In Genesis 3, 8 to 10, we see Adam and Eve when they were convicted of their guilt. God had told them not to eat of the tree of knowledge. They went ahead and did it. Then God comes looking for them. And what do? They hide. And it's quite easy to try, not saying it's easy to do it, but it's easy to try to hide from guilt. Pretend it never happened. Pretend it's not there. Ignore the little voice, the conscience that says, "What have you done?" or "What haven't you done?" But hiding from it is unsuccessful. We see with Adam and Eve that God actually came looking for them and put his finger on it. You know, some time ago there was an engineering firm in Sheffield and they manufactured various parts. And what would happen is a person would be given a job and they got to make, I don't know, 50 of these or 60 of these or whatever. And what used to happen at the end of each week, if you'd made a mistake and actually bungled something so that it had tarnished it, and as we call it, it's a scrapper, what would happen is those were saved, and at the end of the week they get the people standing out in front of their machines, and the things that they'd scrapped would be put in front of them for everybody to see. And the manager would walk up and down and say, "Oh, you've done 3 this week, you've done 2 this week, you know, look at that, 5, everybody look, he's made 5 mistakes this week." And it used to get to the state where to prevent that occurring, the workers had sort of got this little scheme. Where the firm was, the River Don ran around by it. And if you made a scrapper, you would walk by the appropriate window and whang this out into the river. Hide it. The only problem was that because most of the stuff was made of steel, you used to get this orangey flow from the river at different points where this stuff had landed. So it was fairly obvious that things were ending up in the river. It wasn't a successful method of hiding things, although it got you out of the weekly sort of humiliation. Hiding doesn't work. Things that are buried like that do not remain hidden. So it's not a good idea to try and hide from guilt. Some people can be consumed with the guilt, and in many ways that's what we see with the brothers. But another example we read about is in Matthew 26. 14 to 16, it says this, "Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, 'What are you willing to give me if I deliver him over to you?'" Speaking of Jesus, of course. "So they counted out for him 30 pieces of silver. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over to them." And then later on in Matthew 27, verses 3 to 5, we read this. "When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. He said, 'I have sinned. I have betrayed innocent blood.'" So he got a really sort of there pat on the back from the chief priests, because their reply to him was, "So what's that to do with us?" That's your responsibility. So Judas threw the money back into the temple, left, went away and hanged himself. He got a really sort of good reception there from them. "That's your problem. Nothing to do with me. That's your problem, mate. You've done it. It's all on you." But he was so consumed with the guilt that he couldn't bear it. And the only way he saw out was to commit suicide. And people can be consumed with guilt. Not everybody who's consumed with guilt will kill themselves, but it will be there like that black dog following them day and night. And just like with the brothers, it might not be so easily seen to everybody else, but it's never far from their waking moments. It's something that they're thinking about. Guilt has a purpose, but that purpose is not torment. In Galatians 3:23-24, Paul writing says, "Before the coming of faith, we were held in custody under the law, locked up until the faith that was to come would be revealed. So the law was our guardian until Christ came, that we might be justified by faith." God sets his law in our hearts. And it talks there about this guardian, this pedagogos, who almost like one who in the sort of times that we're looking at was like a guardian who would escort the children to school. It showed them the way that they ought to be going. And what Paul's saying is the law's like that. It's showing you the path. You've got a choice. You don't have to follow the guardian. You can sort of, okay, today playing hooky. Next time he walks around a corner, I'm back this way. The law is meant to lead us along the path and show us it has no power to get us there. That's the part that faith plays. But the purpose of guilt is to say, you've actually strayed from this path. This is the path that you should be walking on. The law gives us the path. But guilt comes along and says, you've gone off the path. The issue we have is that through repeated rejection, we can become hardened. In Romans 2:5, it says, "Because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart," we can sort of really dig our heels in. We see that with Pharaoh when Moses came to him. It says he hardened his heart. Not having that. In Ephesians 4:19, it says, these people having lost all sensitivity, or having become calloused in their hearts, they've given themselves over to sensuality. 2 Timothy 3:3 talks about it being an unfeeling heart. But God, when he comes, as he says, I'm going to give you a new covenant, I'm going to give you a heart of flesh, as opposed to a heart of stone, a feeling heart, a heart that's sensitive, a heart that when the guilt comes, says, I've done wrong, I'll put it right. And guilt is not meant to torment us. Guilt is meant to remind us of what we've done wrong. It's like the sort of warning flag that goes up and says, there's a problem. It needs sorting. If you're driving in your car and you get what they call an idiot light come on, that's what they call them. There's an issue here. It needs sorting out. I know someone who was doing exactly this. They were going along, they were on the motorway, light came up, and they pulled over onto the, well, we don't have them in smart way to motorways, but they pulled over onto the hard shoulder. And then they phoned somebody who they knew was good with cars and said, what should I do? And this guy said, you need to call out your AA. You're in the AA, call out the AA. Don't go any further, stay there. Well, actually, that advice wasn't what the person was after. So another phone call was made to somebody else and said, I've got this light come on. What should I do about it? Funnily enough, the advice that was given was exactly the same. You're in the AA, don't go any further, stay there, let them sort it out. Well, there was nobody else to phone, so what was done? The car was started up, and they went back on the motorway. Went a few miles, and then they stopped. When those lights come on, it's saying there's a problem, there's an issue. You go further, you could have an even bigger problem. And the guilt is like the idiot light. It's a flash to us that says, whoa, there's an issue. Sort it. Hebrews 3:13 says, encourage one another daily as long as it's called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. We're called to encourage one another. We're called to work with one another, talk with one another. It's not a case of, oh, I've got to come to you and tell you about this that you've done wrong. But in the general conversation, we encourage one another to do the right thing, so that when the idiot light flashes, when the guilt comes, we respond. And God's speaking to us through that. In Acts 2:36 to 37, when Peter's preaching to the assembled crowd, it says this. He said to them, let all Israel be assured of this, that God has made this Jesus whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah. And when the people heard this, it says they were cut to their heart. And what was the reaction? Didn't say, well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, but we'll call that the end of the day. It says, they said, what must we do? There's a problem. It's flagged up. There's an issue. We've been made aware of this. We need to respond. The brothers were in this unresolved state. The brothers had this fermenting away, bubbling away. It's an issue for them. But they don't try and sort it. And even at this point, they didn't seek any forgiveness. But Joseph addressed it, and the way that he spoke to them, it was clear that he already forgave them. We see how Joseph views the events. He sees that God is working through it all. He had forgiven them, but they didn't really accept it, because in many ways they'd never forgiven themselves. What Joseph said did not penetrate through the astonishment, through the fear, through the horror. We see that both in the instance in Genesis 45 and again when they come to in Genesis 50, excuse me, it says Joseph wept. because they just did not get it. Their hearts were condemning them because they knew they'd done wrong. And you know, the enemy will leap onto every opportunity that is there to accuse, to point out, to say, look at this. How could you do this? What a performance. What have you done? In Zechariah 3, verses 1 to 2, Zechariah writing says, he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at the right side of him to accuse him. The Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a man, a burning stick snatched from the fire? So that we can be in a situation where we've done wrong. Satan can accuse, make us feel really bad. Will that drive us to be consumed by it, as Judas was? Or will it remind us that what Jesus has done for us has overcome that, and be, as it says here, like people who've been snatched from the fire? Forgiveness is readily given by God, but we can choose whether we hold on to the guilt or let go of the guilt and let God just take it from us, remove it from us completely. In 1 John 3:19 to 20, it says, this is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence. If our hearts condemn us, we know that God is greater than our hearts and he knows everything. So as Christians, we can be in the place where we're condemned over what we've done, what we've not done, what we've said, not said, what we've thought. But once that's been given up to God, God is greater than our hearts and doesn't condemn us. It's already paid for. It's already been sorted. How can we possibly be forgiven for that? Well, God says he's already done it. We need to accept that. If it's something that we've done against somebody else, then first of all, we still need to receive forgiveness from God. We may, after that, have to go and ask forgiveness from somebody because of what we've done. The issue is that God will forgive us, but the people might not. There will be consequences. We may have to work through it. We might have to endure the situation. Have you ever heard it said, I can never forgive X. I can never forgive that. And don't get me wrong, there's some heinous things being done and said. Terrible acts perpetrated. And there's that sort of part of you that sort of identifies with the, I could never forgive. But actually, it's not a case of I can never forgive. It's a case of I will not forgive, because it's a choice. And as Christians, we really have no choice. We are taught to forgive. I'm not saying there should be no punishment. I'm not saying there should be no consequences of sin. I'm not saying that justice must not be served. But we need to be, if we're in that position, people who will forgive anything. Because anything can be forgiven, because God's already forgiven it. He shows us the way. He has forgiven everything, including that. It's already under the blood. It's already been taken care of. God has forgiven. And it's our choice whether we align ourselves with him or not. We see in the parable of the unmerciful servant, where a man owed 10,000 bags of gold, as it says, brought before the ruler. The ruler says, well, that's it. You know, you're going to be carted off. Your family's going to be sold off. And he says, please have mercy on me. So he says, okay, it's forgiven. Then the guy goes out, finds somebody else. This one owed him just a small amount. Again, The one owing asks for forgiveness, and the one who has been forgiven, and the one who is now in the position to forgive, says no. Upshot, how on earth could you ever do that? You've been forgiven so much more. No matter what's happened, no matter what's been done, what been not done, we need to be people who forgive, because we are people who have been forgiven. I've also heard it said, well, I can't forgive them because they've not repented. I can't forgive them because they have not asked for forgiveness. But we see with the illustration of Joseph, his brothers did not ask for any forgiveness to start off with, but he forgave them. We see that he was very clear. God has done this. God has sorted it out, and I'm okay with it, and I will look after you. He didn't actually mention the words forgive, but through his actions he demonstrated that he had forgiven them. And that's the God thing to do. In Luke 23:33-34, talking about Jesus, he said, when they come to the place of the skull, they crucified him along with the criminals, one on his right, one on his left. And Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Nobody who was crucifying him asked for forgiveness. None of them came to him and said, sorry, mate, but it's my job and I've got to do it. They just got on with it. But he forgave them and asked the Father to forgive them too. In Romans 5:6-8, it says, you see, just at the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrated his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The payment was made without being asked. The act was accomplished without any part of us saying we need it. In 2 Corinthians, it talks about God reconciling us and being the one who sends the message of reconciliation. We make effective what God has done for us by repenting, by accepting what God has done. But he does it for us anyway. But people go to hell not because the price isn't paid. It's because they reject the offer of forgiveness that is there and choose to stand on their own merit. Because the price is paid for all. God so loved the world that he gave his Son that all, not some, not those who repent, but all. He offers himself for all. But to live in a place of unforgiveness is a choice. It can be an easy choice because it can be very hard to forgive, but it's a choice nonetheless. Joseph's brothers had been forgiven by Joseph. Told them several times that he would take care of them and their families, but they hadn't forgiven themselves. They didn't really believe that Joseph could forgive them for what they'd done. Unlike the brothers, we need to be people who can give forgiveness, be like our Father in heaven. And we need to be people who can receive forgiveness. These are powerful lessons. They can take a lifetime to work through. Take a lifetime to fully understand and comprehend. But if we don't, we will be impoverished. If we do, we can live a life to the full, the life that God intends. We can live in the blessing of God, living in his forgiveness with no debt remaining, either to be paid or owed in any way to God or man. Let's do it. Amen.